Rest a while and have more of the same. Your mother not a bit put out by your appetite because there was enough for everyone, and more where that came from. The master said, Classy, you are a poet of the palate. No one knew what palate meant till three of us went around the corner to see if the Andrew Carnegie librarian might let us look at the big dictionary near her desk. She said, What do you want to know palate for? And when we told her that's what Paddy Clossie was a poet of, she looked up the word and said our teacher must be losing his wits. Paddy was stubborn. He asked her what palate was, and when she said it was the center of taste sensation, he looked delighted with himself and made clucking noises with his tongue. He even did it, going through the streets, till Billy Campbell asked him to stop, as it was making him hungry. We confessed to breaking all the Ten Commandments. If you said you committed adultery or coveted your neighbor's wife, the master knew you didn't know what you were talking about. Don't get above yourself, boy, and moved on to the next penitent. After First Communion, we continued examination of conscience for the next sacrament, confirmation. The priest said examination of conscience and confession would save us from hell. His name was Father White, and we were interested in him because one of the boys said he never wanted to be a priest at all. His mother forced him into the priesthood. We doubted that boy, but he said he knew one of the maids at the priest's house, and she said Father White got drunk at dinner and told the other priest his only dream was to grow up and drive the bus that went from Limerick to Galway and back, but his mother wouldn't let him. It was strange to be examined by someone who became a priest because his mother made him. I wondered if the dream of the bus was in his head while he stood at the altar saying Mass. It was strange also to think of a priest getting drunk because everyone knows they're not supposed to. I used to look at buses passing by and picture him up there smiling away and no priestly collar choking the life out of him. When you get into the habit of examining your conscience, it's hard to stop, especially when you're an Irish Catholic boy. If you do bad things, you look into your soul, and there are the sins festering. Everything is either a sin or not a sin, and that's an idea you might carry in your head the rest of your life. Then when you grow up and drift away from the church, mea culpa is a faint whisper in your past. It's still there, but now you're older and not so easily frightened. When you're in a state of grace, the soul is a pure, dazzling white surface, but your sins create abscesses that ooze and stink. You try to save yourself with mea culpa, the only Latin words that mean anything to you or God. If I could travel to my 27th year, my first teaching year, I'd take me out for a steak, a baked potato, a pint of stout. I'd give myself a good talking to. For Christ's sake, kids, straighten up. Throw back those miserable bony shoulders. Stop mumbling. Speak up. Stop putting yourself down. In that department, the world would be happy to oblige. You're starting your teaching career, and it isn't an easy life. I know I did it. You'd be better off as a cop. At least you'd have a gun or a stick to defend yourself. A teacher has nothing but his mouth. If you don't learn to love it, you'll wriggle in a corner of hell. Somebody should have told me, Hey, Mac, your life, Mac, 30 years of it, Mac, is going to be school, 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 kids, 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 papers, 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 read and correct, mountains of papers piling up at school, at home, days, nights, reading stories, poems, diaries, suicide notes, diatribes, excuses, plays, essays, even novels, the work of thousands, thousands of New York teenagers over the years, a few hundred working men and women, and you get no time for reading Graham Greene or Dashiell Hammett, F. Scott Fitzgerald, or good old P.G. Woodhouse, or your main man, Mr. Jonathan Swift. You'll go blind reading Joy and Sandra, Tony and Michelle, Little Agonies and Passions and Ecstasies, mountains of kid stuff, Mac. If they opened your head, they'd find 1,000 teenagers clambering all over your brain. Every June, the graduate grow up, work, and move on. They'll have kids, Mac, who'll come to you someday for English. And you're left facing another term of Joys and Sandras, Tonys and Michelles, and you'll want to know, Is this what it's all about? Is this to be your world for 20, 30 years? Remember, if this is your world, you're one of them, a teenager. You live in two worlds. You're with them day in, day out, and you'll never know, Mac, what that does to your mind. Teenager forever. June will come, and it's bye-bye, teacher. Nice knowing you. My sister's going to be in your class in September, but there's something else, Mac. In any classroom, something is always happening. They keep you on your toes. They keep you fresh. You'll never grow old. But the danger is you might have the mind of an adolescent forever. That's a real problem, Mac. You get used to talking to those kids on their level. Then when you go to a bar for a beer, you forget how to talk to your friends, and they look at you. They look at you like you just arrived from another planet. And they're right. Day after day in the classroom means you're in another world, Mac. So, teacher, how'd you come to America and all that? I tell them about my arrival in America at 19 years of age, that there was nothing about me, on me, in my head or suitcase, to suggest that in a few years I'd be facing 5 classes a day of New York teenagers. Teacher, I never dreamed I could rise so high in the world. Except for the book in the suitcase, everything I wore or carried off the ship was secondhand. Everything in my head was secondhand, too. Catholicism, Ireland's sad history, a litany of suffering and martyrdom drummed into me by priests, schoolmasters, and parents who knew no better. The brown suit I wore came from Nosey Parker's pawn shop, Parnell Street, Limerick. My mother bargained for it. The nose said, "That suit will be £4. And she said, "Is it codding me you are, Mr. Parker?" "No, I'm not codding you," he said. "That suit was worn once by a cousin of the Earl of Dunraven himself, and anything worn by the aristocracy has higher value." My mother said she wouldn't care if it was worn by the Earl himself for all the good he and his ilk ever did for Ireland with their castles and servants, and never a thought for the sufferings of the people. She'd offer £3 and not a penny more. The nose snapped that a pawn shop was no place for patriotism, and she snapped back that if patriotism was something you could show on the shelf there, he'd be polishing it and overcharging the poor. He said, "Mother of God, missus, you were never like this before. What came over you?" What came over her was that this was like Custer's last stand, her last chance. This was her son Frank going to America, and she couldn't send him off looking like this, wearing the relics of all decency, this one's shirt, that one's trousers. Then she showed how clever she could be. She had very little money left, but if Mr. Parker could see his way to throwing in a pair of shoes, 2 shirts, 2 pairs of socks, and that lovely green tie with the golden harps, she wouldn't forget the favor. It wouldn't be long before Frank would be sending home dollars from America, and when she needed pots, pans, and an alarm clock, she'd think immediately of the nose. Indeed, she could see 6 items there on the shelves she couldn't live without once the dollars came pouring in. The nose was no daw. From years behind the counter, he knew the tricks of his customers. He knew also my mother was so honest she hated owing anybody anything. He said he valued her future custom, and he himself wouldn't want to see that lad there landing shabby in America. What would the Yanks say? So for another pound, oh, take off another shilling, she could have the extra items. My mother said he was a decent man, that he'd get a bed in heaven, and she wouldn't forget him. And it was strange seeing the respect passing between them. The Lane people of Limerick had no use for pawnbrokers, but where would they be without them? The nose had no suitcases. His customers were not known for traveling the world, and he had a good laugh over that with my mother. He said, "World travelers, how are you?" She looked at me as if to say, "Take a good look at the nose, for it isn't every day you'll see him laugh." Feathery Burke in Irishtown had suitcases for sale. He sold anything old, second-hand, stuffed, useless, or ready for the fire. Ah, yes, he had the very thing for the young fellow going to America, God bless him, that would be sending money home to his poor old mother. "I'm hardly old," said my mother, "so none of your plumas. How much for the suitcase?" "Yerra, missus, I give it away to you for £2, because I don't want to be standing between the boy and his fortune in America. My mother said that before she'd pay £2 for that worn-out piece of cardboard held together by a spit and a prayer, she'd wrap my things in brown paper and twine and send me off to New York like that. Feathery looked shocked. Women from the back lanes of Limerick were not supposed to carry on like that. They were supposed to be respectful of their betters and not rise above their station, and I was surprised myself to see my mother in that pick-quarrel mood. She won, told Feathery. What he was charging was pure robbery. We were better off under the English, and if he didn't come down in his price, she'd go to that decent man Nosey Parker. Feathery gave in. God above, missus! A good thing I didn't have children, for if I did and I had to deal with the likes of you every day, they'd be standing in the corner whimpering with the hunger. She said, pity about you and the children you never had. She folded the clothes into the suitcase and said she'd take the whole lot home so that I could go and buy the book. She walked away from me up Parnell Street, puffing on a cigarette. She walked with energy that day, as if the clothes and the suitcase and my going away would open doors. I went to a man in his bookshop to buy the first book in my life, the one I brought to America in the suitcase. It was the works of William Shakespeare gathered into one volume, published by the Shakespeare Head Press, Oldham's Press Limited, and Basil Blackwood, MCMXLVII. Here it is, cover crumbling, separating from the book, hanging on through the kindness of tape. A well-thumbed book, well-marked, there are passages underlined that once meant something to me, though I look at them now and hardly know why. Along the margins, notes, remarks, appreciative comments, congratulations to Shakespeare on his genius, exclamation marks indicating my appreciation and befuddlement. Inside the cover I wrote, oh, that this too solid flesh, etc. It proves I was a gloomy youth. When I was 13, 14, I listened to Shakespeare plays on the radio of Mrs. Purcell, the blind woman next door. She told me Shakespeare was an Irishman, ashamed of what he came from. A fuse blew the night we listened to Julius Caesar, and I was so eager to find out what happened to Brutus and Mark Antony, I went to a man in his bookshop to get the rest of the story. A sales clerk in the shop asked me in a superior way, if it was my intention to buy that book, and I told him I was thinking about it, but first I'd have to find out what happened to everyone in the end, especially the one I liked, Brutus. The man said, never mind, Brutus, pulled the book away from me and said, this was not a library, and would I kindly leave? I backed into the street, embarrassed and blushing and wondering at the same time why people won't stop bothering people. Even when I was small, 8 or 9, I wonder why people won't stop bothering people, and I've been wondering ever since. The book was 19 shillings, half a week's wages. I wish I could say I bought it because of my profound interest in Shakespeare. It wasn't that way at all. I had to have it because of a film I saw where an American soldier in England went around spouting Shakespeare and all the girls fell madly in love with him. Also, if you even hint that you read Shakespeare, people give you that look of respect. I thought if I learned long passages, I'd impress the girls of New York. I already knew friends, Romans, countrymen, but when I said it to a girl in Limerick, she gave me a curious look, as if I were coming down with something. Going up O'Connell Street, I wanted to unwrap my package and let the world see me with Shakespeare in my oxter, but I didn't have the nerve. I passed the small theatre where I once saw a travelling company perform Hamlet, and remembered how I felt sorry for myself for the way I'd suffered like him. At the end of the play that night, Hamlet himself returned to the stage to tell the audience how grateful he and the cast were for our attendance and how weary he was, he and the cast, and how much they'd appreciate our help in the form of small change, which we could deposit in the lard tin by the door. I was so moved by the play because so much of it was about me and my gloomy life that I dropped sixpence into the lard tin and wished I could have attached a note to let Hamlet know who I was and how my suffering was real and not just in a play. Next day I delivered a telegram to Henrietta's hotel, and there was the cast from Hamlet drinking and singing in the bar while a porter ran back and forth loading a van with their luggage. Hamlet himself sat alone at the end of the bar, sipping his glass of whiskey, and I don't know where the courage came from, but I said hello to him. After all, we both had been betrayed by our mothers, and our suffering was great. The world would never know about mine, and I envied him for the way he was able to express his anguish every night. "Hello," I said, and he stared at me with two black eyes under black eyebrows and a white face. He had all those words from Shakespeare in his head, but now he kept them there, and I blushed like a fool and tripped over my feet. I rode my bicycle up O'Connell Street in a state of shame. Then I remembered the sixpence dropped into the lard tin, sixpence that paid for their whiskey and singing at Henrietta's bar, and I wanted to go back and confront the whole cast and Hamlet himself and tell them what I thought of them with their false stories of weariness and the way they drank the money of poor people. Let the sixpence go. If I went back, they'd surely throw Shakespeare words at me, and Hamlet would stare at me again with his cold black eyes. I'd have no words for that, and I'd look foolish if I tried staring back at him with my red eyes. My student said spending all that money on a Shakespeare book was dumb, no disrespect intended. And if I wanted to make an impression on people, why didn't I go to the library and copy down all the quotes? Also, you'd have to be pretty dumb to be impressed with a guy just because he quoted this old writer that no one could read anyway. Sometimes they have these Shakespeare plays on TV. You can't understand a word, so what's the use? The money I paid for the book could have been spent on something cool, like shoes or a nice jacket or, you know, taking a girl to the movies. Some girls said that was real cool, the way I use Shakespeare to make an impression on people, though they wouldn't know what I was talking about. Why did Shakespeare have to write in that old language nobody could understand? Why? I couldn't answer. They said again, "Why?" I felt trapped, but all I could do was tell them I didn't know. If they waited, I tried to find out. They looked at one another. "The teacher doesn't know. How could that be? Is he for real? Wow, how did he get to be a teacher? Hey, teacher, man, you got any more stories?" "No, no, no. You keep saying no, no, no." "That's it. No more stories. This is an English class. Parents are complaining." "Oh, man, Mr. McCourt, you ever in the army? You fight in Korea?" I never thought much of my life, but I went on doling out bits and pieces of it. My father's drinking days in Limerick slums when I dreamed of America, Catholicism, drab days in New York, and I was surprised that New York teenagers asked for more. I told them that after my 2 years in the army, the GI Bill helped me doze through 4 years at New York University. I worked nights to supplement my allowance from the government. I could have attended part-time, but I was eager to graduate and impress the world and women with my degree and my college knowledge. I was expert at making excuses for late papers and missed exams. I shuffled and mumbled the mishaps of my life to patient professors, hinted at great sadnesses. The Irish accent helped. I lived on the edge of fate and begorra. University librarians poked me when I snored behind a stack of books. One librarian told me snoozing was strictly forbidden. She was kind enough to suggest that out in Washington Square Park there was no end of benches where I could stretch till the cops came. I thanked her and told her how I'd always admired librarians, not only for their mastery of the Dewey Decimal System, but for their helpfulness in other areas of daily living. The professor of education at New York University warned us about teaching days ahead. He said first impressions are crucial. He said the way you meet and greet your first class might determine the course of your whole career. Your whole career. They're watching you. You're watching them. You're dealing with American teenagers, a dangerous species, and they'll show you no mercy. They'll take your measure, and they'll decide what to do with you. You think you're in control? Think again. They're like heat-seeking missiles. When they go after you, they're following a primal instinct. It's the function of the young to get rid of their elders, to make room on the planet. You know that, don't you? The Greeks knew it. Read the Greeks. The professor said that before your students enter the room, you must have decided where you'll be, posture and placement, and who you'll be, identity and image. I never knew teaching could be that complicated. He said, you simply cannot teach unless you know where to position yourself physically. That classroom can be your battleground or your playground, and you have to know who you are. Remember Pope. Know thyself, presume not God to scan, the proper study of mankind is man. First day of your teaching, you are to stand at your classroom door and let your students know how happy you are to see them. Stand, I say. Any playwright would tell you that when the actor sits down, the play sits down. The best move of all is to establish yourself as a presence, and to do it outside in the hallway. Outside, I say. And that's your territory, and when you're out there, you'll be seen as a strong teacher, fearless, ready to face the swarm. That's what a class is, a swarm, and you're a warrior teacher. It's something people don't think about. Your territory is like your aura. It goes with you everywhere, in the hallways, on the stairs, and assuredly in the classroom. Never let them invade your territory. Never. And remember, teachers who sit or even stand behind their desks are essentially insecure and should try another line of work. I like the way he said assuredly. The first time I ever heard it used outside of a Victorian novel. I promised myself that when I became a teacher, I'd use that word too. It had an important sound to it that would make people sit up and pay attention. I thought it was terrific the way you could stand up there on that little platform with your podium and your desk and talk for an hour with everyone before you making notes. And if you had any kind of good looks or personality, the girls would be tripping over themselves to see you afterward in your office or anywhere else. That's what I thought at the time. The professor said he'd made an informal study of teenage behavior in high school, and if we were sensitive, observant teachers, we'd notice certain phenomena moments before class bells rang. We'd notice how adolescent temperatures rose, blood raced, and there was enough adrenaline to power a battleship. He smiled, and you could see how pleased he was with his ideas. We smiled back because professors have the power. He said, teachers must observe how students present themselves. He said, so much, I say, depends on how they enter a room. Observe their entrances. They amble, they strut, they shuffle, they collide, they joke, they show off. You yourself might think nothing of entering a room, but for a teenager it can be everything. To enter a room is to move from one environment to another, and that for the teenager can be traumatic. There be dragons, daily horrors from acne to zit. I could barely understand what the professor was talking about, but I was very impressed. I never thought there was so much involved in stepping into a room. I thought teaching was a simple matter of telling the class what you knew and then testing them and giving them grades. Now I was learning how complicated the life of a teacher could be, and I admired this professor for knowing all about it. The student next to me in the professor's class whispered, "This guy is so full of crap. He never taught a high school class in his life." The student's name was Seymour. He wore a yarmulke, so it was no wonder he said wise things from time to time. Or he could have been showing off for the red-haired girl sitting in front of him. When she looked over her shoulder to smile at Seymour's remarks, you could see she was beautiful. I wished I could have shown off myself, but I rarely knew what to say, whereas Seymour had an opinion on everything. The red-haired girl told Seymour if he felt that strong, he should speak up. "Hell no," said Seymour. "I'd be up my ass." She smiled at him, and when she smiled at me, I thought I'd float out of my seat. She said her name was June, and then raised her hand for the professor's attention. "Yes?" "Professor, how many high school classes have you taught?" "Oh, I've observed dozens of classes over the years." "But have you ever actually taught in a high school? What's your name, young lady? June Summers. Haven't I just told you I've observed and supervised dozens of student teachers? My father's a high school teacher, Professor, and he says you know nothing about high school teaching till you've done it. He said he didn't know what she was getting at. She was wasting the time of this class, and if she wanted to continue the discussion, she could make an appointment with his secretary to meet in his office. She stood and slung her bag strap on her shoulder. No, she would not make an appointment to see him, and saw no reason why he couldn't simply answer her question about his teaching experience. That's enough, Miss Somers. She turned and looked at Seymour, glanced at me, and walked toward the door. The professor stared and dropped a piece of chalk in his hand. By the time he retrieved it, she was gone. What would he do now about Miss June Somers? Nothing. He said the hour was nearly over. He'd see us next week, picked up his bag and walked out. Seymour said June Somers had screwed herself royally, royally. He said, one thing I'll tell you, don't mess around with professors. You can't win, ever. The following week, he said, did you see that? Jesus. I didn't think someone wearing a yarmulke should say Jesus like that. How would he like it if Yahweh or G-D were a curse and I blasted him with it? But I said nothing for fear he might laugh at me. He said, they're going out. I saw them in a MacDougall Street cafe, all lovey-dovey, drinking coffee, holding hands and looking into each other's eyes. God damn, I guess she had a little chat in his office and moved on. My mouth was dry. I thought someday I'd run into June and find my tongue and we'd go to a movie together. I choose something foreign with subtitles to show how sophisticated I was, and she'd admire me and let me kiss her in the dark, missing a dozen subtitles in the thread of the story. That wouldn't matter, because we'd have plenty to talk about in a cozy Italian restaurant where candles flickered and her red hair twinkled back, and who knows what that would lead to, because that was as far as my dreams would go. Who did I think I was anyway? What made me think she'd look at me for 1 second? I prowled the coffee shops of MacDougall Street, hoping she might see me and smile, and I'd smile back and sip my coffee so casually she'd be impressed, take a second look. I'd make sure she'd see the cover of my book, something by Nietzsche or Schopenhauer, and she'd wonder why she was wasting her time with Professor when she could be with that sensitive Irishman sunk in German philosophy. She'd excuse herself and on her way to the ladies' toilet drop a scrap of paper on my table with her phone number. Which is what she did the day I saw her at the Café Figaro. When she left the table, the professor looked after her with such an air of ownership and pride, I could have knocked him from his chair. Then he glanced at me, and I knew he didn't even recognize me as a student from his class. He called for his bill, and while the waiter stood at his table obscuring his view, June was able to drop that scrap of paper on my table. I waited till they left. Frank, call me tomorrow. The telephone number was scrawled in lipstick. God! She noticed me. A dockside laborer fumbling my way toward a teaching career. And the professor was, Jesus! A professor! But she knew my name. I was weak in the head from happiness. There was my name on a paper napkin with lipstick that had touched her lips, and I knew that I'd keep that piece of paper forever. I'd be buried with it. I called her, and she asked if I knew where we could have a quiet drink. Chumley's. Okay. What would I do? How would I sit? What would I say? I was having a drink with the most beautiful girl in Manhattan, who probably slept every night with that professor. That was my Calvary, thinking of her with him. Men in Chumley's looked at me and envied me, and I knew what they were thinking. Who is that miserable specimen with that beautiful girl, that knockout, that stunner? Yeah, maybe I was her brother or cousin. No, even that was unlikely. I wasn't good-looking enough even to be her third or fourth cousin. She ordered a drink. Norm's away, she said. He teaches a course in Vermont 2 days a week. I suppose Big Mouth Seymour told you everything. No. So why are you here? You invited me. What do you think of yourself? What? Simple question. What do you think of yourself? I don't know. She looked disapproving. You call when you're told to call, you appear when you're told to appear, and you don't know what you think of yourself. For Christ's sake, say one good thing about yourself. Go ahead. I felt blood rushing to my face. I had to say something or she might get up and walk away. A platform boss on the piers once said I was a tough little Mick. Oh, well, take that remark in a dime and you can ride the subway two stops. You're a lost soul. That's easy to see. Norm likes lost souls. Words jump from my mouth. I don't care what Norm likes. Oh, God, she'll get up and walk away. No, she laughed so hard she nearly choked on her wine. Then everything was different. She smiled at me and smiled and smiled. I felt so happy I could barely stay in my skin. She reached across the table and put her hand on mine, and my heart was a mad animal in my chest. Let's go, she said. We walked to her apartment on Barrow Street. Inside, she turned and kissed me. She moved her head in a circular way so that her tongue traveled clockwise in my mouth, and I thought, Lord, I am not worthy. Why didn't God tell me about this before my 26th year? She said I was a healthy peasant and obviously starved for affection. I didn't like being called a peasant. Jesus, hadn't I read books, every word of E. Laurie Long, P. G. Woodhouse, Mark Twain, E. Phillips Oppenheim, Edgar Wallace, and good old Dickens? And I thought what we were doing here was more than showing affection. I said nothing because I had no experience of activities like this. She asked me if I liked monkfish, and I said I didn't know because I'd never heard of it before. She said everything depended on how you cooked it. Her secret was shallots. Not everyone agrees with that, she said, but it worked for her. It's a delicate white fish, best cooked with a good white wine. Not an ordinary cooking wine, but a good one. Norm cooked fish once, but he made a mess of it. Used some piss from California that turned the fish into an old shoe. The poor dear knew his literature and his lecturing, but nothing about wine or fish. It's strange to be with a woman who takes your face in her hands and tells you to have faith in yourself. She said, my father came from Liverpool, and he drank himself to death because he was afraid of the world. He said he wished he was a Catholic so he could join a monastery and never have to see a human being again, and it was my mother who tried to get him to say good things about himself. He couldn't, so he drank and died. Do you drink? Not much. Be careful. You're Irish. Your father wasn't Irish. No, but he could have been. Everyone in Liverpool is Irish. Let's cook that monkfish. She handed me a kimono. It's okay, change in the bedroom. If it's good enough for a samurai, it's good enough for a tough little Mick who ain't so tough. She changed into a silver dressing gown that seemed to have a life of its own. One moment it clung to her, then hung in a way that let her move freely inside. I preferred the clinging part, and it kept me alive inside my kimono. She asked if I liked white wine, and I said yes, because I was learning that yes was the best answer to every question, at least with June. I said yes to the monkfish and the asparagus and the two flickering candles on the table. I said yes to the way she raised her wine glass and touched it against mine till they went ping. I told her this was the most delicious dinner I'd ever had in my life. I wanted to go on and say I was in heaven, but that might sound forced, and she might give me the kind of strange look that would ruin the whole night and my life beyond. Norm was never mentioned in the six nights that followed the night of the monkfish, except that there were 12 fresh roses in a vase in her bedroom, with a card that said Love from Norm. I drank extra wine to boost my courage enough to ask, how the hell can you lie in this bed with me in the presence of Norm's fresh roses? But I never did. I couldn't afford roses, so I brought her carnations, which she put in a large glass jar beside the roses. There was no competition. Beside Norm's roses, my carnations looked so sad, I bought her a dozen roses with my last few dollars. She sniffed at them and said, oh, they're beautiful. I didn't know what to say, as I hadn't grown them, just bought them. Norm's roses in the glass jar looked dry, and it made me happy to think my roses would replace them, but what she did then gave me the greatest pain I ever had in my heart. From my chair in the kitchen, I could see what she was doing in the bedroom, taking my roses one by one and placing them delicately among, between, and around Norm's roses, standing back, looking at them, using my fresh roses to prop up the roses of Norm that were going limp, stroking the roses, his and mine, and smiling as if one set of roses was as good as the other. She must have known I was watching. She turned and smiled at me, suffering, nearly blubbering in the kitchen. "They're beautiful," she said again. I knew she was talking about 24 roses, not just my dozen, and I wanted to yell something at her and storm out like a real man. I didn't. I stayed. She made stuffed pork chops with applesauce and mashed potatoes, and it tasted like cardboard. We went to bed, and all I can think of was my roses mingled with his, that son of a bitch in Vermont. She said I seemed low in energy, and I wanted to tell her I wished I was dead. "It's okay," she said. "People just get used to each other. You have to keep it fresh." Was this her way of keeping it fresh? Juggling two of us at one time, stuffing her vase with flowers from different men? Near the end of that spring term, I met Seymour on Washington Square. "How's it going?" he said, and laughed, as if he knew something. "How's the gorgeous June?" I stammered and shifted from one foot to the other. He said, "Don't worry. She did it to me too, but she had me only 2 weeks." I knew what she was up to, and I told her to go to hell. "Up to? It's all for old Norm. She has me up, she has you up, and Christ knows who else she has up. And she tells Norm all about it. But he goes to Vermont." "Ah, Vermont, my ass. The minute you leave her place, he's in there lapping up the details." "How do you know?" "He told me. He likes me. He tells her about me. She tells him about you. And then I'm telling you about them. And they have a hell of a time. They talk about you and how you don't know your ass from your elbow about anything." I walked away and he called after me. "Anytime, man. Anytime." I scraped through the teacher's license examination. I scraped through everything. Passing score in the teacher examination was 65, mine was 69. The passing points came, I think, through the kindness of an English chairman at Eastern District High School in Brooklyn who judged my demonstration lesson, and my good luck in having a skimpy knowledge of the poetry of the Great War. An alcoholic professor at NYU told me in a friendly way that I was a half-assed student. I was offended till I thought about it and realized he was right. I was half-assed all around, but promised that someday I'd pull myself together, focus, concentrate, make something of myself, snap out of it, get my act together, all in the good old American way. We sat on chairs in the corridors of Brooklyn Technical High School, waiting for interviews, filling out forms, signing statements, declaring our loyalty to America, assuring the world we were not now, nor had we ever been, members of the Communist Party. I saw her long before she sat beside me. She wore a green scarf and dark glasses, and when she pulled off the scarf, there was a dazzle of red hair. I had the yearning ache for her, but I wouldn't give her the satisfaction of turning to look. "Hi, Frank." If I were a character in a novel or movie, I would have stood up and walked away proud. She said, "Hi," again. She said, "You look tired." I snapped at her to show I was not going to be polite after what she did to me. "No, I'm not tired," I said. But then she touched my face with her fingers. That fictional character would have pulled his head back to show he hadn't forgotten, was not going to soften because of two greetings and a few fingertips. She smiled and touched my cheek again. Everyone in the hallway was looking at her, and I thought they were wondering what she was doing with me. She was that gorgeous, and I was hardly a prize. They saw her hand in mine. "How are you anyway?" "Fine," I croaked. I looked at that hand and thought of it roaming across Norm's body. She said, "Are you nervous about the interview?" I snapped again. "No, I'm not." "You'll be a fine teacher." "I don't care." "You don't care? So why are you going through this?" "There's nothing else to do." "Oh?" She said she was getting a teacher's license to teach for a year and write a book about it. This was Norm's suggestion. Norm, the big expert. He said education in America was a mess, and a muckraking book from inside the school system would be a bestseller. Teach a year or two, complain about the terrible state of the schools, and you have a big seller. My name was called for the interview. She said, "How about coffee afterwards?" If I'd had any pride or self-esteem, I would have told her no and walked away, but I said okay and went to my interview with my heart pounding. I said good morning to the three examiners, but they're trained not to look at teacher candidates. Man in the middle said, "You have a couple of minutes to read the poem on the desk before you. After you've read it, we'll ask you to analyze it and tell us how you teach it to a high school class." The title of the poem described how I felt at that interview. "I would I might forget that I am I." Bald man on the right asked if I knew the form of the poem. "Yes, oh yes, it's a sonata."
"A what?"
"Oh, I'm sorry, a sonnet, 14 lines.
And the rhyme?"
A-B-B-A-A-B-B-A-C-D-C-D-C. They looked at one another, and I didn't know if I was right or wrong.
"And the poet?"
I think it's Shakespeare. No, no, Wordsworth."
"Neither, young man. It's Santayana."
The bald man glared at me as if I had offended him. "Santayana," he said. "Santayana." And I almost felt ashamed of my ignorance. They looked grim, and I wanted to declare that asking questions about Santayana was unfair and unjust due to the fact he was in no textbook or anthology I ever looked at in my 4 dozing years at New York University. They did not ask, but I volunteered the only knowledge I had of Santayana, that if we don't learn from history, we're bound to repeat our mistakes. They looked unimpressed, even when I told them I knew Santayana's first name, George. "So," said the man in the middle, "how would you teach this poem?" I babbled. "Well, I think it's partly about suicide and how Santayana's fed up. And I talk about James Dean because teenagers admire him and how he probably killed himself subconsciously on a motorbike. And I'd bring in Hamlet's suicide soliloquy, to be or not to be, and let them talk about their own feelings about suicide if they ever had any." Man on the right said, "What would you do for reinforcement?"
"I don't know, sir. What's reinforcement?"
He raised his eyebrows and looked at the others as if trying to be patient. He said, "Reinforcement is an activity, enrichment, follow-up, some kind of assignment where you clinch the learning so that it's embedded in the student's memory. You can't teach in a vacuum. A good teacher relates the material to real life. You understand that, don't you?"
"Oh."
I felt desperate. I blurted, "I tell them to write a 150-word suicide note. That would be a good way of encouraging them to think about life itself, because Samuel Johnson said the prospect of hanging in the morning focuses the mind wonderfully." Man in the middle exploded.
"What?"
Man on the right shook his head. "We're not here to talk about Samuel Johnson." Man on the left hissed. "Suicide note? You would do no such thing. Do you hear me? You are dealing with tender minds. Jesus Christ, you're excused." I said, "Thank you, but what was the use? I was sure that was the end of me. Easy to see they didn't like me, my ignorance of Santayana and reinforcement, and I was sure the suicide note idea was the last straw. They were high school department heads or had other important jobs, and I disliked them the way I disliked anyone with power over me, bosses, bishops, college professors, tax examiners, foremen in general. Even so, I wonder why people like these examiners are so impolite to make you feel unworthy. I thought if I was sitting in their place, I'd try to help candidates overcome their nervousness. If young people want to become teachers, they should be encouraged and not intimidated by examiners who seem to think Santayana was the center of the universe." That's what I felt at the time, but I didn't know the ways of the world. I didn't know that people up there have to protect themselves against people down here. I didn't know that older people have to protect themselves against younger people who want to push them off the face of the earth. After my interview, she was already in the hallway, knotting her scarf under her chin, telling me, "That was a breeze." "It was no such thing. They asked me about Santayana."
"Really?
Norm adores Santayana."
Did this woman have any sense at all ruining my day with Norm and that damn Santayana? I don't give a shit about Norm. Santayana, too. My, such eloquence. Is the Irishman having a little tantrum? I wanted to hold my chest to calm my rage. Instead, I walked away and kept walking, even when she called, Frank, Frank, we could be serious. I walked across the Brooklyn Bridge, repeating, we could be serious, all the way to McSorley's on East 7th Street. What did she mean? I drank beer after beer, ate liverwurst and onions and crackers, pissed mightily in McSorley's massive urinals, called her from the public phone, hung up when Norm answered, felt sorry for myself, wanted to call Norm again, invite him to a showdown on the sidewalk, picked up the phone, put it down, went home, whimpered into my pillow, despised myself, called myself an ass till I fell into a boozy sleep. Next day, hungover and suffering, I traveled to Eastern District High School in Brooklyn for my teaching test, the last hurdle for the license. I was supposed to arrive an hour before the lesson, but took the wrong subway train and arrived half an hour late. The English department chairman said I could come back another time, but I wanted to get it over with, especially since I knew I was on the road to failure anyway. The chairman handed me sheets of paper with the subject of my lesson, war poems. I knew the poems by heart, Siegfried Sassoon's Does It Matter, and Wilfred Owen's Anthem for Doomed Youth. When you teach in New York, you're required to follow a lesson plan. First, you are to state your aim. Then, you are to motivate the class because, as everyone knows, those kids don't want to learn anything. I motivate this class by telling them about my aunt's husband, who was gassed in World War I, and when he came home, the only job he could find was shoveling coal, coke, and slack at the Limerick Gas Works. The class laughs, and the chairman smiles slightly, a good sign. It isn't enough to teach the poem. You are to elicit and evoke, involve your students in the material, excite them. That is the word from the Board of Education. You are to ask pivotal questions to encourage participation. A good teacher should launch enough pivotal questions to keep the class hopping for 45 minutes. A few kids talk about war and their family members who survived World War II in Korea. They say it wasn't fair the way some came home with no faces and no legs. Losing an arm wasn't that bad because you always had another. Losing two arms was a real pain because someone had to feed you. Losing a face was something else. You only had one. And when that was gone, that was it, baby. One girl with a lovely figure and wearing a lacy pink blouse said her sister was married to a guy who was wounded at Pyongyang, and he had no arms at all, not even stubs where you could stick on the false arms. So her sister had to feed him, shave him, do everything, and all he ever wanted was sex. Sex, sex, sex. That's all he ever wanted, and her sister was getting all worn out. The chairman in the back of the room says, Helen, in a warning voice, and she says to the whole class, Well, it's true. How would you like to have someone you have to give a bath to and feed and then go to bed with three times a day? Some of the boys snicker but stop when Helen says, I'm sorry. I get so sad over my sister and Roger because she said she can't go on. She'd leave him, but he'd have to go to the veterans' hospital. He said if that ever happened, he'd kill himself. She turns around to speak to the chairman in the back of the room. I'm sorry over what I said about sex, but that's what happened, and I didn't mean to be disrespectful. I admired Helen so much for her maturity and courage and her lovely breasts I could hardly go on with the lesson. I thought I wouldn't mind being an amputee myself if I had her near me all day, swabbing me, drying me, giving me the daily massage. Of course, teachers were not supposed to think like that, but what are you to do when you're 27 and someone like Helen is sitting there in front of you bringing up topics like sex and looking the way she did? One boy will not let go. He says Helen's sister shouldn't worry about her brother-in-law committing suicide because that would be impossible when you didn't have arms. If you didn't have arms, you didn't have a way of dying. Two boys say you shouldn't have to face life without a face or legs when you're only 22. Oh, sure, you could always get false legs, but you could never get a false face, and who would ever go out with you? That'd be the end, and you'd never have children or anything. Your own mother wouldn't want to look at you, and all your food would have to come through a straw. It was very sad knowing you'd never want to look in the bathroom mirror anymore for fear of what you might see, or what you might not see, a face gone. Imagine how hard it was for the poor mom when she had to decide to throw out her son's razor and shaving cream, knowing he'd never use them again. Never, ever again. She could never actually go into his room and say, "Son, you're never going to use these shaving things anymore, and a lot of stuff is piling up here, so I'm going to throw them out." Can you imagine how he'd feel sitting there with no face and his own mother telling him, in a way, it was all over? You'd only do that to someone you didn't like, and it was hard to think a mother wouldn't like her son, even if he had no face. No matter what condition you're in, your mother is supposed to like you and stand behind you. If she doesn't, where are you? And what's the use of living at all? Some boys in the class wish they had their own war so they could go over there and get even. One boy says, "Oh, bullshit. You can never get even," and they boo him and shout him down. His name is Richard, and they say it's well known around the school what a communist he is. The chairman makes notes, probably on how I've lost control of the class by allowing more than one voice in the room. I feel desperate. I raise my voice. "Anyone here ever see a movie about German soldiers called All Quiet on the Western Front?" "No, they never saw it. Why should they pay money to see movies about Germans after what they did to us goddamn krauts?" "How many of you are Italian?" "Half the class." "Does this mean you'd never see an Italian movie after they fought against America in the war?" "No, it has nothing to do with the war. They just don't want to watch those movies with all those dumb subtitles that move so fast you can never catch up with the story. And when there is snow in the movie and the subtitles are white, how the hell are you supposed to read anything? A lot of these Italian movies come with snow and dogs taking a leak against the war. And they're depressing anyhow with people standing in streets waiting for something to happen." The Board of Education ruled that a lesson must have a summary that puts everything together and leads to a homework assignment or reinforcement or some kind of outcome, but I forget, and when the bell rings, there's an argument going on between two boys, one defending John Wayne, the other saying he was a big phony who never went to war. I try to pull everything together in one grand summary, but the discussion dribbles away. I tell them thank you, but no one is listening. And the chairman scratches his forehead and makes notes. I walk towards the subway berating myself. What was the use? Teacher my arse. I should have stayed in the army with the dogs. I'd be better off in the docks and the warehouses, lifting, hauling, cursing, eating hero sandwiches, drinking beer, chasing waterfront floozies. At least I'd be with my own kind, my own class of people, not getting above myself, Akushla. I should have listened to the priests and the respectable people in Ireland who told us, "Beware of vanity, accept our lot. There's a bed in heaven for the meek of heart, the humble of soul." Mr. McCourt, wait up. That was the chairman calling from half a block away. Wait up. I walked back towards him. He had a kind face. I thought he was there to console me with a "too bad, young man." He was out of breath. "Look, I'm not supposed to even talk to you, but I just want to say you'll be getting your exam results in a few weeks. You have the makings of a fine teacher. I mean, for Christ's sakes, you actually knew Sassoon and Owen. I mean, half the people walking in here can't tell the difference between Emerson and Mickey Spillane, so when you get your results and you're looking for a job, just call me, okay?" "Oh, yes, sure, yes, I will. Thanks." I danced along the street, walked on air, birds chirped on the elevated subway platform. People looked at me with smiles and respect. They could see I was a man with a teaching job. I wasn't such an idiot after all. Oh, Lord, oh, God, what would my family say? A teacher. The word will go around Limerick. Did you hear about Frankie McCourt? Jesus, he's a teacher over there in America. What was he when he left? Nothing. That's what he was, poor, miserable bugger that looked like something the cat brought in. I'd call June, tell her I was offered a teaching job already in a high school, not as high up as Norman the professor, but still. I stuck a dime into the phone box. It dropped. I put the phone down again. Calling her meant I needed to call her, and I didn't need to need. I could live without her in the tub and the monkfish and the white wine. The train rumbled in. I wanted to tell people, sitting and standing. I was offered a teaching job. They'd smile up from their newspapers. No! No call to June. Let her stay with Norm, who destroyed monkfish and knew nothing about wine. Depraved Norm, who couldn't take June as she was. No! I'd make my way downtown to Port Warehouses, ready to work till my teacher's license arrived. My teacher's license, I'd like to wave it from the top of the Empire State Building. When I called about the teaching job, the school said sorry. The kindly chairman had passed away, and sorry, no positions were available, and good luck in my search. Everyone said as long as I had the license, I'd have no trouble finding a job. Who the hell would want a lousy job like that? Long hours, low pay. And what gratitude do you get for dealing with the brats of America? Which is why the country was crying out for teachers. School after school told me, sorry, your accent's going to be a problem. Kids, you know, like to mimic. And we'd have Irish brogues all over the school. What would parents say when the kids come home sounding like, you know, Barry Fitzgerald? You understand our position? Assistant principals wondered how I managed to get a license with that brogue. Didn't the Board of Education have any standards anymore? I was disheartened. No room for me in the great American dream. I returned to the waterfront, where I felt more comfortable. Hey, Mr. McCourt, did you ever do real work? Not teaching, but, you know, real work? Are you joking? What do you call teaching? Look around this room and ask yourself if you'd like to get up here and face you every day. You! Teaching is harder than working on docks and warehouses. How many of you have relatives working along the waterfront? Half the class, mostly Italian, a few Irish. Before I came to this school, I worked in Manhattan, Hoboken, and Brooklyn Piers, I said. One boy said his father knew me from Hoboken. I told him. After college, I passed the exams for the teacher's license, but I didn't think I was cut out for the life of a teacher. I knew nothing about American teenagers. Wouldn't know what to say to you. Dockside work was easier. Trucks backed in. We swung our hooks. Haul, hoist, pull, push, stack on pallets, forklift slides in, lifts the load, reverses, stacks the load in the warehouse and back to the platform. You work with your body and your brain had a day off. You worked 8 to noon, had a foot-long sandwich and a quart of beer for lunch, sweated it off from 1 to 5, headed home, hungry for dinner, ready for a movie and a few beers in a Third Avenue bar. Once you got the hang of it, you moved like a robot. You kept up with the strongest man on the platform and size didn't matter. You used your knees to save your back. If you forgot, platform men would bark, Christ's sakes, you got a rubber spine or something? You learned to use the hook different ways with different loads, boxes, sacks, crates, furniture, great chunks of greasy machinery. A sack of beans or peppers had a mind of its own. It can change shape one way or another, and you have to go with it. You look at the size, shape, and weight of an item, and you knew in a second how to lift and swing it. You learned the ways of truckers and their helpers. Independent truckers were easy. They worked for themselves, set their own pace. Corporation truckers prodded you to hurry up, man, lift the damn load, let's go, I want to get out of here. Truckers' helpers were surly, no matter who they worked for. They played little games to test you and throw you off, especially if they thought you were just off the boat. If you worked close to the edge of pier or platform, they'd suddenly drop their side of the sack or crate hard enough to pull an arm from its socket, and you learned to stay away from the edge of anything. Then they'd laugh and say, Faith in Begara, Paddy, or Top of the Morning with a fake Irish accent. You'd never complain to a boss about any of this. He'd say, What's the matter, kid? Can't you take a little joke? Complaining only made matters worse. The word might get to a trucker or a helper. He might accidentally bump you off the platform or even the pier. A big new man from Mayo took offense when someone put a rat's tail in his sandwich, and we threatened to kill whoever did it. He was accidentally toppled into the Hudson, and everyone laughed before they threw him a line and hauled him out, dripping with river scum. He learned to laugh, and they stopped bothering him. You can't work the piers with a long face. After a while, they stop picking on you, and the word goes around that you know how to take your lumps. Eddie Lynch, the platform boss, told me I was a tough little mick, and that meant more